hollow out our force. It will weaken us at the very moment when the United States needs to remain the strongest military power on Earth.
The military braces for another round of budget cutting. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, September 6th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, thousands of Anchorage residents are still waiting for electricity while the power companies explain why it's taking so long.
We work on areas that have the most amount of people, so we try to prioritize it to get the most result out of the effort that we're expending.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska,
and by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment, on the web at arcticwirerope.com.
Governor Parnell's staff is standing by their decision not to preserve or make public any information sent as cell phone text messages. The practice was revealed a month ago in a story done by the Anchorage Daily News in which a former Parnell employee charged that text messages were used to avoid public disclosure of what might otherwise be available for scrutiny. The chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee, Hollis French, today released a legal opinion by a legislative attorney that explained that state law defines public records as books, papers, files, accounts, writings including drafts and memorializations of conversations, and other items regardless of format or physical characteristics. French says that the technology doesn't relate to the point of law.
The public expects that written records, in whatever form they take place, whether it's a Facebook message, an email, a text message, to be saved so that they can review the work of their government. That's the idea, and as technology changes, we just have to make sure that the law stays abreast of those changes.
In an emailed comment, Parnell's press secretary Sharon Lehow said, quote, "Text messages are transitory and are not saved. The administration does not consider text messages public records." French says that's an unfortunate interpretation of an increasingly common means of communication.
The whole point of the Public Records Act is to allow the public to see the decisions of government captured in whatever form they take place. More and more people are going to text messages. It's functionally identical to an email. So I think the governor and his staff should rethink their position.
The Supreme Court is expected to weigh in indirectly on the dispute when it issues a decision on whether state business transacted on private email accounts is subject to the state's public records law. Scientists studying Cook Inlet belugas have watched the dramatic decline of their numbers from 1,300 in the 1970s to only 300 now. Biologists, state and federal officials, commercial fishermen, and oil and gas developers all speculate about why the belugas haven't rebounded after they were put on the endangered species list in 2008. But there are no concrete answers. David Martin is the president of the Cook Inlet Drift Association, or UCEDA. Martin has been fishing in Cook Inlet for more than 40 years. He thinks food availability for the whales isn't the issue, saying there are plenty of salmon and ulacon for them to eat. He thinks the decline started with overharvest by subsistence hunters in the 1990s that took the animals too far down.
And in that same time frame, the orca whales, which feed on belugas, we're increasing in numbers, and the combination of the two, I think, have kept the beluga numbers at a low level.
But National Marine Fisheries Service biologist Barbara Mahoney says while there are records of some predation by orcas on beluga whales, there's nothing that indicates it happens frequently. Instead, NIMS is looking into a wide range of other possible causes of the beluga's decline, including industrial development in the inlet that causes noise and possible habitat impacts during calving time. She says they have studied pollutants in the whales' bodies, but the tests don't point to a smoking gun.
For most of the contaminant load study, they're lower than the healthy population in the Chukchi Sea belugas.
Bob Shavelson is the advocacy director for Cook Inlet Keeper. He says contaminant tests need to search for drugs being flushed down toilets and making their way into the bay.
One of the concerns is what are called emerging pollutants, and these are things like pharmaceuticals and birth control pills and Viagra, and even in very, very low amounts, these pollutants can have adverse effects on marine life.
Shavelson says the EPA's secondary treatment exemption for the Anchorage sewage system that allows the city to essentially screen out the solids and add chlorine to the effluent before discharging into the inlet is a problem. He says the EPA should not treat Cook Inlet like an ocean.
EPA has failed to characterize Cook Inlet as an estuary. An estuary is a place where fresh and salt water meet. I mean, clearly it meets the definition of an estuary, which brings about a different set of rules. Instead, EPA says, oh no, it's an ocean. And as an ocean, it can assimilate a lot more pollution. It all comes down to legal definitions and basically a predetermined outcome.
Shavelson also has concerns about toxins being dumped into the inlet from the oil and gas development industry. But Barbara Mahoney says all of the studies that have been conducted on Cook Inlet belugas and their environment are not conclusive, and the reasons behind the lack of a rebound are just not clear.
You know, it's a great mystery, and I think everyone would like to have one point and say this is it, and if we fix this, we would have the animals recovering. But it could be just a blend of possibilities of why everything adds a little bit more weight to why they can't recover right now, or maybe it's just taking longer, or there might be something that we don't know at this time and we're hoping to find out.
Funding is a problem, and NIMS is working to get more money to investigate the belugas in greater detail. The annual survey results on the estimated numbers of the whales will be out in November. A new report looking at contaminant loads is also due later this year. Unless Congress creates and agrees to a viable plan to reduce trillions of dollars from the deficit, the federal government will face massive cuts January 2nd. The cuts, known as the sequester, will slash $1.2 trillion from federal agencies. The deeply unpopular sequester will send ripples through virtually every element of government. And as APRN's Peter Granitz reports, the cuts at the Pentagon could shock military spending in Alaska, both in the public and private sectors.
As part of the Budget Control Act of 2011, the Pentagon lost $487 billion, and it planned on that, crafting its defense policy to reflect leaner times. There was a second part of the Budget Control Act, one that stipulated if the supercommittee could not find agreement on deficit reduction, the federal government would cut an additional $1.2 trillion of spending, and about $500 billion of that sum will come from the Pentagon. Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta has not hid his frustration, anger, and worry. Here he is speaking at a dinner in Washington in June.
It will pose, if it happens, and I've made this clear, an unacceptable risk to our ability to defend this country. Make no mistake, it will hollow out our force, it will weaken us at the very moment when the United States needs to remain the strongest military power on Earth.
But many think the Pentagon could use a right-sizing of what they call a bloated budget. Ben Freeman is an investigator with the nonpartisan Project on Government Oversight. He says the cuts would reduce defense spending by about $54 billion a year.
We spend far more than any of our enemies, our would-be enemies. And so to say that we're going to cut just 10% off of our budget, we're still going to spend far more than any other country in the world.
Still, Freeman says sequester is not the right approach. Specifics of just what the cuts mean to military operations and base life are hard to come by. Representatives from J-Bear, Fort Wainwright, and Eielson Air Force Base all said they are waiting on guidance from the Pentagon. And Lieutenant Colonel Elizabeth Robbins, a Pentagon spokesperson, says defense is waiting on guidance from the Office of Management and Budget. That could come as soon as today.
It will force the release of temporary civilian employees and impose at least a partial hiring freeze and potentially unpaid furloughs on our Department of Defense civilian personnel.
President Barack Obama exempted military personnel from the cuts. The 21,000 members of the military in Alaska will not lose their jobs or see a reduction in pay. But the Pentagon still needs to plan on losing 10% of its budget, so the cuts to non-personnel spending will be even larger. Colonel Robbins says Congress needs to pass a law to stave off what she calls a disaster.
We know that it will universally disrupt our acquisition programs and our training programs, reducing base support services, delaying payments to medical service providers.
Much of that gets done outside of government. The Department of Defense spent $3 billion last year in Alaska on private contracts. The biggest recipient was Crowley Petroleum Distribution. Its headquarters are in Florida, and the company supplies the military with fuel. Its Alaska contracts in 2012 are worth more than $300 million. 80% of defense contracts in the state went to Alaska Native-owned businesses, like PetroStar. PetroStar, a subsidiary of the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, also supplies the military with fuel. Since the beginning of 2012, PetroStar has been awarded contracts worth $200 million. No one from the companies was comfortable commenting on what potential cuts to the Pentagon would mean for business. Ben Freeman says more than half of the Pentagon budget is spent on contracts. And because of the exemption for military personnel, contractors can expect less business. But he says even if all the cuts went directly towards contracts, the industry would still take in more than $300 billion a year.
If you think $300 billion a year is catastrophic, I think you need a wake-up call.
It's not just contractors who could feel the pinch. So could civilians who live near bases, from the cashier at the grocery store to the carpenter who planned on doing work to a base employee's house. And weapon systems may come under even more scrutiny. In Alaska, Freeman says the F-22 should be in the sights of budget cutters. It's never flown in combat. It's expensive, and pilots complain of the plane's effects on their health.
If you have a plane that you're not really using to defend the nation, and it costs $50,000 an hour to fly, that's certainly a ripe candidate for some budget cuts.
But most think that's not how the sequester will work. Top brass at the Pentagon may not go through and find wasteful programs. They may reduce each program by a flat rate. And anyone associated with the military, enlisted members, contractors, and civilians, is likely to see changes. And until the Pentagon lays out what they are, everyone is left in the dark. In Washington, D.C., I'm Peter Granitz.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a jogger in Sitka has a frightening bear encounter with a happy ending.
When she stepped up on the knob, essentially she was looking right at the bear's butt.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Doyon Limited, celebrating 40 years as Interior Alaska's regional native corporation, providing oil field services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. And by
Alyeska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the Trans-Alaska Pipeline with over 700 employees.
There are still thousands of people without power in Anchorage after a huge windstorm hit Tuesday night. The bulk of them are customers of Chugach Electric Association. The CEO of Chugach, Brad Evans, says crews are working as fast as they can to restore power to the remaining 2,000 to 3,000 customers, including two schools. But it's impossible to give an exact time when the lights will be back on. That's because crews have a triage system for making repairs.
We work on areas that have the most amount of people. If we have a large fuse that's got 100 homes on it, and you have a fuse down the road that's got six people on it, we're going to work on that fuse tap line that has the 100 people, because if we restore the service there, it might be the identical amount of effort for the six, but we restored 100 people. So we try to prioritize it to get the most result out of the effort that we're expending.
The September 4th storm knocked out power to 25,000 Chugach customers. On Thursday, dozens of customers were lined up at the company's headquarters to report their outages in person because they said they could not get through on phone lines. Evan says the company has around 20 crews working around the clock and will add an additional 7 or 8 crews Friday. He estimates power will be restored to the remaining customers over the weekend. Matanuska Electric Association officials said as of today, they still have 700 customers without power. Anchorage Municipal Light and Power officials say 300 customers don't have power. Anchorage Mayor Dan Sullivan has remained silent on how the municipality is handling the aftermath of the storm. He hasn't said whether he'll be asking the governor to declare the windstorm damage a disaster. The aftermath of Tuesday's windstorm in Anchorage is evident all over city streets and backyards. Tree services are working overtime to deal with emergency situations first, such as trees on housetops or tangled in power lines, before they tackle less dangerous downed trees. Many city residents are still waiting for the chipper to arrive. But as KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports, state and city officials are advising them to be patient.
Homeowners in Midtown Anchorage are dealing with 30 feet or so of weeping birch. The once proud sentinel of 23rd Avenue now lies prone across two front yards while two men work to cut it with chainsaws.
Well, yeah, we both are. That's Paul. He's my friend helping us out. So.
I lost two in my backyard.
Yeah.
Nobody's hurt, huh?
No, nobody got hurt. It fell in the most perfect place you could have had it fall.
No,
well, it hit the truck a little bit over there. It's got a little dent in there.
Kids are playing in the huge piles of green leafy branches, and neighbors gather to watch and swap stories about how they weathered the big storm. The birch is obviously free of power lines or cables of any kind, but State Department of Natural Resources Community Assistance Forester Stephen Nickel is warning people to look twice and think twice about tackling a tree cutting job on your own.
Down trees can be a lot more tricky than trees that are standing that are undamaged. The way that the trees fall down, they can load branches. They can, if you cut them with a chainsaw, they can spring back at you. They're loaded. The branches, the trunks are loaded kind of funny. And if you don't know what you're doing, you can cause yourself some damage. So if you're unsure, I'd really, really recommend that folks just call the professionals, because these guys do this stuff every day.
Nickel offers some long-term advice, too. Plan for adverse weather in advance by taking proper care of your backyard trees.
If there was any patterns that were emerging that I, from what I saw driving around town yesterday and checking out the carnage, I would say some of the big trees, they're going to fail because they are big. I mean, there was a lot of those that came down. But a lot of the trees that failed, those failures could have been prevented through proper care, either through proper pruning of some of the trees that have developed, codominant stems or included bark, certain defects that predispose them to failing in a windstorm.
He says a tree's sail or its canopy can handle wind for sure, but sometimes a tree's placement makes the difference whether it stands or falls. Anchorage Tree Services are getting blitzed with calls for help. All of them are working overtime this week and through the weekend to help with the cleanup, along with city crews. State maintenance worker Tom Jenkins worked chipping fallen tree limbs near Lake Hood Thursday.
So that's what we're going around, is chipping them away so they're not in the way of the public.
Meanwhile, Anchorage City woodlots are staying open extra hours so people can deal with the debris left after the storm. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
A very special flagpole snapped during the big storm in downtown Anchorage Tuesday night. The 110-foot Sitka spruce log was sent up to the citizens of Anchorage from the city of Ketchikan in 1999, according to a plaque found at the Veterans Memorial on the Delaney Park Strip where it stood. The wind sheared the pole at the base. KSKA's Daisha Eaton has more.
Mike Pollitt works as a carpenter for the municipality of Anchorage. He spent Wednesday morning cleaning up storm damage downtown. Most of his time was spent at the Veterans Memorial on the Delaney Park Strip near Minnesota.
110-foot pole, and as you can see, it went south. The wind was blowing southwest and pushed it over.
Pollitt says the pole went down Tuesday night as the storm was ramping up around 10 o'clock.
Fortunately, it didn't damage the base or didn't hit the soldier going toward the road there at Minnesota, and it went the right way. Fortunately, nobody was hurt. That was a big plus, and we're just going to clean it up, and I'm sure veterans, either veterans or I'm not sure who it would be, but they'll start the process of trying to get a new pole.
A plaque at the memorial says the first Sitka spruce flagpole was given to the citizens of Anchorage in 1959. In 1987, it says the original flagpole was trimmed and moved from City Hall to the Delaney Park Strip. Then in 1999, a new pole was sent up to replace the old one. Atop the pole was a giant American flag, which blew away during the storm. The pole also held a time capsule in a globe that rested on top of it, Lindsay Witt, the communications manager for Mayor Dan Sullivan's office, says the capsule was found by a copy editor at the Anchorage Daily News and delivered to City Hall Wednesday afternoon.
Unfortunately, it was opened, and so we're not sure if we have received all of the contents.
Witt says it contained a number of items from around the time the poll went up.
A old Maxwell House can that looks like it has tar all over, maybe old duct tape, a poster from May 7th, 1961 with a list of firefighters' names, and a section of the Anchorage Daily News, which cost 10 cents. A penny was also found from 1960 in the can, and a Union 76 gas card from Charles Gillick.
The mayor's office is looking into what all the stuff in the time capsule means, she says, and anyone with information about the items should call their office. For now, the Parks and Recreation Department has removed the flagpole from the park strip and is storing it until the municipality decides what to do with it. Cal Kerr says he worked as a forester for the Division of Forestry in the 1970s. Now he says he works in a building right across from the park strip near the flagpole at the Veterans Memorial. He says he came to check out the pole when he heard it had gone down, and he noticed the signs of rot on the pole right away.
What we've got is a cylinder of rot around the diameter, circumference actually, of the tree, and when it blew over, it shattered up about halfway. And it's an indication of dry rot.
And perhaps it can be protected from rotting like its predecessors, Kerr says. Downtown Anchorage resident Emery Couples says he came to Alaska from Idaho on a steamboat with his family in the summer of 1940, and he's seen a lot of change downtown. He says he remembers when the flagpole originally went up.
I remember there was quite a bit of news and interest because it was the same time that the Veterans Memorial was put here.
He also remembers the 1964 earthquake that happened a few years later. Couples says he feels like the old wooden flagpole coming down is a metaphor for how things are changing in his city.
Neighborliness has kind of disappeared. It has lost that small town flavor, the pioneer flavor. People stand next to each other and text back and forth instead of talking. That's kind of sad.
And he says he hopes the relatively minor damage left in the wake of the big storm of 2012 will serve as a reminder to the people who live in Anchorage now to get to know their neighbors and to be prepared for when a real disaster hits. In Anchorage, I'm Daisha Eaton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by First National Bank Alaska, helping Alaska's dreams grow since 1922. On the web at fnbalaska.com, an equal housing lender, member FDIC. The Kinnick Arm Bridge will create 1,500 jobs during the 4 years of construction and spur thousands more after completion by creating access to affordable land for commercial, industrial, and residential use. For facts on the Kinnick Arm Bridge, visit kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority.
When Secretary of State Hillary Clinton arrives in Vladivostok this weekend for APEC, the Asia-Pacific Economic Cooperation Summit, she'll have an agenda focused on a rising China, a troubled Syria, and issues with Iran. But she'll also meet with her Russian counterpart, Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov, to take the first steps towards establishing an international area dedicated to preserving the natural and cultural heritage of Beringia. It's officially called the Transboundary Area of Shared Beringian Heritage. It covers nearly 20,000 miles of Alaska's Seward Peninsula and Russia's Chukotka Peninsula. The shared area aims to facilitate international studies in the Arctic, ensure the protection of subsistence species, and aid in conservation. Janice Kozlowski with the National Park Service says the idea has been around for more than half a century.
But it wasn't until 1990 when then-President Bush and Gorbachev got together, and they really wanted to make something happen. And so they agreed that they would continue to try and push the idea.
Kozlowski says the Park Service has been conducting outreach to communities on the Seward Peninsula since 2010 on what this kind of international designation would mean.
At that time, we described to them what the possibilities were. And we told them that there was a renewed interest in the idea. And we also spoke with the regional corporations and the IRAs and others in the larger population centers. And I think, honestly, it's taken some time for people to think about it and understand the options and try and understand the implications of each possibility.
In Alaska, two national parks, the Bering Land Bridge National Preserve and the Cape Krusenstern National Monument, will be part of the transboundary area. In Russia, a new national park would bring five separate areas together to create the Chukotsky National Park. Many components of the transboundary area are still being finalized, but Kozlowski says the signing of the memorandum by Secretary Clinton and Foreign Minister Lavrov this Saturday will be a high-level push to have making the shared park a reality. An 18-year-old Vancouver, British Columbia resident suffered minor injuries after being attacked by a brown bear sow on a popular trail near Sitka. The young woman was traveling on the state ferry with her family. The attack occurred on the Mosquito Cove Trail on Tuesday, about a mile from the Sitka ferry terminal. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
Mosquito Cove is a mile and a quarter loop that begins and ends in the Forest Service campground in the Stargavin Valley. The woman, Nicola Rammel, was out in front of the rest of her family jogging during a ferry layover. The area of trail where she met the sow runs along the ocean and the thick forest fringe at the base of a cliff. ADF&G biologist Phil Mooney says the bear and cub were traveling in the same direction as Rammel, who had almost no time to react.
When she stepped up on the knob, essentially, she was looking right at the bear's butt, and she yelled and turned around to flee and fell off the corner of the trail there and down the hill, and the bear pounced on her and bit her in the buttocks.
The episode was not quite over.
She screamed again, and the bear let her go and turned around and rejoined its cub, and she stood up and waved at the bear and yelled at the bear, and the bear charged her again, bluff charged, and didn't make any physical contact that time, and then turned around and picked up the cub and left the scene.
Mooney says the sow is probably a new mother, around 7 years old. Her cub was born this year and appears a little scrawny for this late in the summer. The sow has had two other notable encounters with people. A few weeks ago, she bluff charged the occupants of the Stargavin Recreation Cabin. And just the day before this incident, she climbed up on the boardwalk and bluff-charged a local resident who had gotten between the sow and her cub. The Forest Service has now closed all trails and the campground in the Stargavin Valley. Alaska State Troopers describe Rammel's injuries in the attack as minor. She was treated and released and allowed to continue on her trip with her family. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. You can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton and Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Matthew Smith in Nome, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Dave Donaldson reported from Juneau and Peter Granitz from Washington, D.C. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Bristol Bay Native Corporation, generations of jobs, heritage, and history. Bristol Bay, a place that's always been. Online at bbnc.net. Young drivers, texting and cell phone use while driving create distractions. Don't let your next text cause a wreck. If your middle or high school is interested in having a youth representative speak to your students about workplace safety, call Alaska Occupational Safety and Health Youth Safety at 1-800-656-4972. This message is sponsored by Alaska Labor Standards and Safety.
Alaska Housing Finance Corporation offers home choice seminars that provide tools for making informed decisions about purchasing and financing a home and loans tailored for first-time home buyers. There's more information at ahfc.us. This message sponsored by Alaska Housing Finance Corporation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.